and welcome to A&M Ad, our series on accelerating DPI, or Distributed to Paid in Capital, delivery for PE clients. Today, we are launching a string of consumer-focused chats with insight from senior industry leaders. I am Su Ying, a director in the performance improvement practice in Southeast Asia and Australia, and I'm excited to be joined by Nayantara Bali, a senior advisor at A&M and also incredibly seasoned business leader with 30 plus years of experience in the consumer space. She's held multiple senior positions in Procter & Gamble over a 25-year period and is currently an independent director in Marico, StarHub, Inchcape, and Torrent Pharma. Welcome, Nayantara.
Hi, Su Ying. Delighted to be here and looking forward to this chat.
So thank you so much for being here today to talk about how to drive category development and building a moat. So let's start off with CDI, or Category Development Index. So what exactly is CDI and why is it important?
Yeah, that's a great question, Su Ying. So basically, when we look at growth opportunities, or when a lot of companies look at growth opportunities, particularly in, sort of ASEAN, India, or developing markets in general, one of the things that looks very attractive is the growth potential, right? And typically, we are all familiar with the PowerPoint decks, which show that, categories are very small relative to, let's say, more developed markets. And therefore, there's a huge opportunity for, whatever business somebody is looking at to grow. And this is true, right? So, typically, let's take laundry detergents or diapers or any of these categories. What typically we look at is how many pieces or how many units per consumer is being consumed in that market, right? And that represents how well the category is developed, or the category development index. And obviously, if it's very low, let's say, just for example, that in a market like India, on average, a consumer is using, let's say, one diaper a year. And I'm just cooking up the numbers, right? These are not actual numbers. And the equivalent number in the US or Western Europe is, let's say, 100, mm-hmm. Right? So that gives you an example or an idea of how much, that the India market has to grow in the diaper category as incomes grow and, as economic development happens. And obviously, India has a large number of babies. So so what becomes important to companies is not so much about competing amongst the existing competitors for that one diaper a year, but really looking at how can you go from one to two and two to four and so on, right? So the things that you do, the way you design the product, the way you decide how you're going to spend your money, what your message is, who you're going to target, all of that becomes very different when you look at developing categories versus competing versus somebody else in the same category. So I hope that gives you some sort of idea of what category development is and why it's so important in developing markets.
Yeah, thank you so much for breaking that down. And so with that, how does CDI then create a moat that is then hard for a new entrant or for competitors to overcome?
Okay, so this is, this is a very important point, because what you don't want to have happen is that you put in all the hard work to develop a category. Developing categories is, very high effort. It's very expensive, because people are probably not using the category or a particular form of the category much. So you have to first convince them to start using the category. And then you've got to get them over time to use more of the category. So this is not an easy task versus, just going into an existing category and saying, hey, you already know everything about this category, and here's how I'm better, right? Now, obviously, that's an easier task. But the rewards of category development can also be very large if it is done smartly. Okay, so what does it mean to create a moat? So if you're going to put in all the hard work of building a category and building your brand, you want to make sure that somebody else doesn't come in and then just take share, market share away from you very easily because you haven't built barriers to entry or what I like to call a moat. Okay, so one of my favorite examples is actually the very first category that I ever worked on, which is feminine care, FemPro. And this is about the launch of Whisper, which is a feminine hygiene product, launched in India in 1989. So, that was sort of my first project. And at that time, the category development of feminine care products, mm-hmm. branded feminine care products in India was exceedingly low. Most consumers, even wealthier consumers, used homemade, either gauze or cloth or whatever, right? And so when Procter & Gamble was entering the category, obviously came in, J&J was the entrenched competitor with their leading brands. They had over 70% market share, but albeit of a very tiny market. And when Procter & Gamble entered, we realized that, this is going to be no fun sort of, just trying to fight for share. And in any case, it's a very high risk averse category. So no one's going to sort of casually, it's not something you just casually try out like candy. The risks of failure are too high. So we had a superior product. And we realized that there were going to be, the only way to show people our superiority was to actually give them free samples and get them to try the product. So the first big investment from a category development point of view was to invest in very large scale sampling. Mm-hmm. Now, when I talk about large scale sampling, I'm talking of millions and millions of girls every year. And there was no infrastructure to be able to execute something like that, mm-hmm. right? How do you actually go and distribute samples to millions of, ladies and girls, okay? And so the company, and, we came up with two sort of ideas or approaches. One was to sample women who could afford to buy the product right away if they were convinced, okay? And this was really people in the age group of, 18 plus or 21 plus. They might have their own money, more independent, able to make their own decisions. And we did a large scale sort of house to house program, sort of targeting, going door to door. So you can imagine what a task this was, hiring agencies had no experience of, having millions of women. It was like an army operation. And we had to take permissions from municipal authorities, and, so that was one whole piece of it. But the moat, so in a way, that was a moat because it was not easy for companies to set up the infrastructure. But it was not a true moat because all the agencies, the company didn't do it themselves. We hired agencies, we developed those agencies. So it is true that those agencies could be hired by our competitors in the future. The real moat that we developed was actually what we call the school program. And what we realized was that if you can sample somebody when they enter the category, when they're entering the category, when they've just sort of started to have their periods, that experience, what they use at that experience is a very key moment of truth. And if they have a good experience with a product at that time, they're likely to always stick to that product. There's a very high loyalty and a very high retention rate. Now, they may or may not be able to afford to buy at that point, but they will definitely, the bar for performance will be set very early on. So we decided that, this is what we're going to invest on. It was not a one-year payout, as you can imagine. It was actually a multi-year payout. It was very difficult to execute because it involved going to schools, building relationships with the schools, and getting permission to do this as part of their, each school had a different program. It could be like a sex education class or a, puberty growing up class kind of thing. And so over a period of a few years, the company built all these relationships, the program, how to execute it, how to make it very meaningful, because it's a big rite of passage kind of experience. And this program was incredibly successful. Now, why is this a moat? This is a moat because now when you have relationship with hundreds of schools across the country, and they are used to you coming there every year, they're relying on you to run that program, it's almost impossible for a competitor to come in and unseat you from that program and from those relationships. And now this, of course, is a very unique sort of example, but I would think that in every category, it's always helpful if you are going to category development and you don't want to do the hard work and somebody let somebody else come and benefit from it, then always think of how can I build moats? Now, they may not last forever, but they can last for a very long time, which so you can always be one step ahead of your competitor. And this is not easy. It requires investment. I think from a PE perspective, their timeframes are not as long. Yes. But definitely, if you can establish that you're beginning or you have an element that can build or create a moat going forward, certainly the valuations will be significantly higher. So I think it's useful to think of this right from the beginning. And really, at least if you can't execute on large scale, have experiments running that show that it can work. When money is there to be invested, you can keep investing.
Yeah, so thank you. That makes a lot of sense. And now that we understand a little bit more about the importance and the value of developing a category, could we talk a little bit about how this translates into adjacencies?
Okay.
Right? So, we work in the PE space. Right. Every time there's a commercial due diligence, the word adjacency will come up.
Yeah.
Back to our conversation, how can a mid-sized company that might be a market leader in a category, so they've developed this moat, how can they actually realize the benefits from adjacencies or for the benefits from, being a category leader? Are there any examples specifically that you can think of?
Sure. So I'd like to share actually two types of examples. One is a company which has already got a big brand going into adjacencies. And the other would be a company which is actually trying to unseat a big brand by going into an adjacency, which can be a very successful way. So in other words, if you have a big brand and you haven't gone into some emerging or important adjacencies, somebody else can come and, sort of steal that from you in a way. Okay. So the first one, just to continue the Whisper example, is after Whisper's launch was very successful, got to market leadership quite fast, actually, within 10 years, they got to very high shares, double digit shares, actually, 30, 40% share and grew the category. So it was a growing share in a growing category. But after a point in time, many companies, J&J was active, Kimberly-Clark entered, local brands started entering. And so over a period of time, the product superiority, others start to catch up. So what Whisper did was actually then launch the next big innovation, which was, so you're probably too young to even remember that such things existed. The pads that we launched at that time were what are called maxi pads or thin, the pads were thickish, right? And then there was this new technology in the 90s created in the US by P&G, which was the ultra-thin gel technology. And so this became a whole new sort of product form that the company very... And that, again, required a lot of category development because it was counterintuitive. How can a thing that is so thin actually be absorbed? And there was a huge barrier to trial, right? So that's the Whisper example. But I think, for an existing brand or company which has, which is very successful, I guess the point is you've got to keep looking out for what are the adjacencies that can broaden the brand and, keep you ahead of others. I will say that Whisper also explored other adjacencies, some of which did not work. So it's always important to see where's the opportunity. We looked at sanitary underwear, as an adjacency,
mm-hmm.
Because it was a very successful item in Japan, where
I
actually
see.
there was a habit of using sanitary underwear. And what I mean by sanitary underwear is that the fit of the underwear had a huge impact on the performance of the pad, actually.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we thought that, you know, this was something that we could try out in India. You know, I mean, people didn't have money to even buy pads, so they sure as heck were not going to buy a sanitary panty to go with it. And we came to the conclusion that the big opportunity is in the base category, offering the main benefit. And so we moved away and we stayed with, in fact, the company has stayed with pads even now, because even now the category development is, you know, still low relative to other markets. Share another example, which is from the personal cleansing segment. And I want to actually mention two examples, one from P&G and one from Unilever, actually. The example from Unilever is of Dove, which I think did a fantastic job of really understanding what was at the core of the Dove brand. Dove started as a bar soap. This is not a brand I worked on, so I'm really looking at it from the outside. But I think they took this idea of real beauty, but mm-hmm. all the, you know, the beauty industry was all about, you know, glamour and, you know, film stars and celebrities and so forth. And they took the idea of real women, real beauty, and a product that works, a good product. And they were very successfully, I think, able to expand into hair care.
Mm-hmm.
They were very successfully, I think, reasonably successfully able to expand into APDO, into deodorants. And then, of course, liquid body wash and all the rest of it. I will say that this is a relatively one of the rarer
mm-hmm.
Examples, but an example of a successful one. The other very successful example is from the fabric softener brand Downy, which mm-hmm. is a Procter & Gamble brand, where it started as an additive, a liquid additive. But the interesting thing that Downy did is they realized that while softening is the benefit, a lot of people were using it for the fragrance. A core group of people who loved laundry and who loved, you know, the fragrance. And especially in developing markets, smaller houses, smelly bathrooms, this whole thing was giving a moment of happiness and joy to a fairly mundane, drudgery type of activity. So they created these softener beads, you know, which is basically very concentrated fragrance that you could pop into the wash for that extra fragrance, and, you know, bring a little joy to someone's life, basically. So I think, you know, there's lots of ways in which you can bring adjacencies. I think what's important is to understand what is the consumer really buying when they're buying that brand.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the case of Dove, they were buying into an idea. Of course, the products have to be good. You know, in the case of Safeguard, they were buying into, you know, cleansing, really good cleansing, which protects me with de-germing, but without sort of giving up the delights or the latest ways to wash yourself. And in the case of the Downy example, a lot of people were, you know, yes, I do my laundry, I plop in some softener so that my towels are not like potato chips or crisps. But the brand was able to identify a group of consumers who actually loved fragrance. So they were able to capitalize on that and create this beads segment. Of course, when you do something like that, you can charge a lot of money for it, right? And because the brand is known, you don't have to, you can shelve it next to the brand, you can just feature it in the brand shot. There's lots of ways to build awareness very quickly amongst your prime target. So adjacencies can be a much cheaper way, unless, of course, category development is again involved, of getting in very quickly and making use of an existing asset, you know, effectively.
Great. So obviously expanding into adjacencies open up new avenues for growth. But a lot of the success of these ventures, you know, hinge on an effective distribution strategy.
Right.
So could we also maybe spend some time discussing distribution? Is distribution a true moat? And how can a brand continue to build depth and breadth in distribution? And if we take that lens and focus on mid-sized Southeast Asian companies.
Sure. So I think this is a great question. Distribution is often the thing that makes or breaks a brand and is very critical. Can it be a moat? Absolutely, it can. Mm-hmm. But it's a very difficult moat, mm-hmm. right? Because what happens with distribution, unless you own your own distribution channel, you basically have to convince whoever is, you know, the target of your efforts. It could be a mom and pop store, which is still very large, what we call the general trade in all of Asia. It could be a big box retailer. It could be an e-commerce retailer. It could be a specialty channel. So it could be any of these. Mm-hmm. Now, I think in Southeast Asia, India, the general trade, if you are going into a sort of a big mass sort of category, or you started as niche, but now you want to become bigger, and the only way to grow is actually to be better distributed. This segment tends to be very, very important. And if you are in a category development type of space or building an adjacency, then being the first person to get into this channel can be a moat. Because when you think of these stores, they're small stores, right? Mm-hmm. They are physically small. They don't have that much space, so they cannot have an unlimited assortment of products. They are also fairly cash strapped. Right. So the turnover of cash is very important to these stores. And if you want to enter without giving endless amounts of credit, cash is obviously a factor. So if you are the first person mm-hmm. to be able to convince these sort of small store owners that it is worthwhile keeping your product and you have, you know, reasonably good support, you convince them that they can keep it and it will definitely be, you know, would move from their store and they make good money on it. And if you have all of that come together, I think it's very difficult for a Me Too brand or anybody else in that same category to come and convince that same retailer, hey, keep me also. Okay, because, you know, the retailer can say, hey, I already got this, it sells well, they're treating me right, I don't need to keep you and take a risk. And if I keep you, then I have to not keep something else in my store. And why should I do that? Okay, so in those kind of situations, I think particularly in the open trade, because you require physical, it's kind of like the sampling example, anything that requires a lot of physical feet on the street, wide reach, it's not easy for somebody to come and unseat you overnight. So that's definitely something that you can do. In e-commerce, mm-hmm. okay, the companies which got in very early and made sure they showed up first yeah. in search and all of that, the next person who comes in, and I think the conversation in e-commerce becomes even more complicated because it's not just about being listed in an e-tailer. It's also about search and reviews mm-hmm. and, you know, nobody buys anything without checking reviews. Nobody looks beyond the first page.
Yeah.
So if you got in early and you have all those reviews and you land up at the top of every search and, you know, you don't have to be paying to be right on top, that can be a moat. Now, the person who has to unseat you has to now spend a lot of money to get to that level. So I think distribution can definitely be a moat, maybe not as long as some other kinds of moats, but definitely it would be high up there in moat creation. Mm-hmm. And whoever comes next has to spend a lot of money and effort and time.
Okay, so then if we think about if you're a mid-sized, company in Southeast Asia, the key here really is to get in early And if you're in a country where there's, you know, a lot of unorganized
Yes.
trade or GT.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Or you have a leader, market leader,
mm-hmm.
who is not playing in a channel, right? So if you have, this happened, frankly, to all the, I would say, the P&Gs and the Unilevers and the L'Oreals, who were very strong in what I would call traditional trade.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in Asia and particularly in China, in skincare and beauty care in particular. And we have so many stories of, very successful beauty care brands which came out of nowhere and mm-hmm. they led with e-commerce because mm-hmm. the Doves and the Olays and the L'Oreals and all of these brands were still so focused on big box and mm-hmm. Physical trade. I'm talking of like 10, 15 years ago. For the company, and especially for mid-sized companies, my thing would be look for opportunities where the big guys are leaving themselves exposed and see if you can enter through that. There's lots of examples of, brands that did that very successfully.
Great. Thank you. This has been a very insightful conversation, Nayantara. And we definitely look forward to having you back for more discussions in this or other topics.
Super. Glad to be helpful in any way. And I hope firms have a lot of success with some of these thoughts.